Heavenly King, Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one.
Thank you, Father Chris, for inviting me to give this month's lecture on St. Gregory of Nyssa, who is and has been for a very long time my favourite saint. Hopefully it's okay to have favourites with these things. And he's a personal favourite for a number of reasons, one of which is that he combines really well in his own person both the philosophical and rational side as well as the mystical or apophatic side. And I'll say something more about this a bit later on. Another reason is that he was, for his time and for his generation, fairly daring, original, and even revolutionary thinker. A lot of his ideas were very revolutionary for their time, and they had a great impact, and they continue to have a great impact today. And I'll say something about his theological ideas in the second half of this talk. So this talk will be divided into two parts. The first part, I'll look at Gregory's life, just give an overview of his life. And the second part, I'll discuss some of his major theological ideas. And I'll really be only able to skim the surface because there's just so much that you could delve into. But hopefully I'll say enough to give you a taste of the great life and theology that Gregory exhibited. Now, one of the interesting things about Gregory is that he's proven to be a very elusive person. A British scholar by the name of Morvina Ludlow, who published this book in 2007, it's not a light read, but it's an excellent book on Gregory of Nyssa. And in this book, she describes Gregory as the elusive Gregory. And this is partly because Gregory has been the subject of a huge variety of interpretations over the past 50 or so years, from historians, theologians, philosophers, and other scholars. And this itself indicates that Gregory has been the subject of a lot of interest in scholarly discussions over the last 50 or so years. This wasn't the case about 100 or so years ago. Nobody really took much notice of Gregory. He was pretty much ignored or neglected. But now his works are very much a hot thing. You know, he's widely discussed and debated. But the elusiveness of Gregory is partly due to the fact that he reveals little about himself in his own writings, and also because no contemporary or friend of his wrote a biography of him. So we don't really know too much about his own personal life. And in her book, Morvina Ludlow begins her book at the very beginning with a whole list of quotations, a long list of quotations from a number of different scholars showing how they think of and see Gregory. And I've reproduced three of these quotations on the PowerPoint slide here. The first one is from Bernard McGinn, who is a very distinguished scholar. He specialises in mysticism and spirituality. And he described Gregory as one of the most penetrating and original thinkers of Greek Christianity. Another scholar from America, Robert Wilkin, who is a specialist in early church history, he described Gregory as a subtle, sophisticated thinker, the most rigorously intellectual of all the early Christian thinkers. He chooses his words with care. An Orthodox scholar, Andrew Louth, has described Gregory as an opponent of the last representatives of the Arian tradition. So the Arian tradition was a very influential heretical movement in the early Christian centuries, and I'll come back to that a bit later. And thus, Gregory consolidated the achievement of Nicaea being the first ecumenical council held in 325, and that opposed the Arian movement. As a speculative theologian, he was certainly the greatest of the three Cappadocians, though inferior to the other two in rhetorical skill and organising ability. So as these quotes indicate, Gregory is held in high regard not only in the Orthodox Church, but even amongst the broader scholarly community. And as the quote from Andrew Louth points out, Gregory is regarded as one of the three Cappadocian fathers. He was the youngest of the three, the other two being his brother, Basil the Great, and their mutual friend, Gregory Nazianzus. Gregory of Nyssa always remained in the shadow of the other two. He was the most speculative, philosophical, and mystical writer of the group, but he was not an outstanding administrator and monastic legislator like Basil was. Basil was a man of action. He was above all else an organizer. Gregory was not an attractive preacher and poet, as was Gregory of Nazianzus. But Gregory is generally regarded to have been the most gifted amongst the three as a speculative theologian, philosopher, and mystic. The depth and breadth of his thought surpassed that of Basil and Gregory of Nazianzus. So Gregory is often considered to have been more gifted in terms of originality and intellectual ability. He made much more use of philosophers like Plato than did the other two. And he was closest of all the Cappadocians to Origen in thought. Origen is a name that will keep coming out in this talk, so I'll just say something very briefly about him now. Origen had a great influence on the early Christian church and especially on the Cappadocian fathers. Origen came from Alexandria in Egypt. He lived around the first half of the 3rd century and is generally regarded to have been the most important theologian and biblical scholar of the early Greek church. But he was a controversial figure, and some of his ideas got him into trouble, and some of his ideas were thought to have been heretical. In character, Gregory was a gentle and retiring spirit. He preferred study and reflection to the life of action, unlike his brother Basil. He had a formidable intellectual nature, which is amazing considering that Gregory never received a formal education. It's something I'll come back to in a minute. He was also sensitive and emotional, and he was regarded simple and naive when it came to public affairs. And I'll return to that a bit later as well. But he was highly respected by the Byzantines, and he was called the Father of Fathers and the Star of Nyssa at the 7th Ecumenical Council in Nicaea in 787. Gregory of Nazianzus, in one of his letters, described him as the column supporting the whole church. And we celebrate his feast day on January the 10th. So let's look now at something of his family, his birth, where he was born, and so on. Gregory was born around somewhere between 335 and 340. He was born in a city called Neo-Caesarea in the Pontus region. And I've got a map here which you can see there, the Pontus region, just north of Cappadocia. And I've got a more detailed map as well, where you can see that's Neo-Caesarea there, the capital of Pontus. Cappadocia here, the capital of Caesarea. Neo-Caesarea was a city that was famous for its first bishop, which was Gregory Thaumaturgos. And Gregory of Nyssa received the name of this saint. Gregory Thaumaturgos was a student of Origen's. It was Origen who introduced him to Christianity and converted him to Christianity. Then he went to Neo-Caesarea and became a bishop there and committed his life to Christianizing that largely pagan area. And he received the surname Thaumaturgos, or the nickname Thaumaturgos, which means wonder worker or miracle worker, because of the many phenomenal miracles he is said to have performed and which aided his missionary work. And one of the people he converted was Gregory of Nyssa's grandmother, St. Macrina the Elder. Gregory's family, it was a truly amazing family by all accounts. It was a family of saints and church leaders, as Father Chris mentioned. It was a cultivated, educated family, aristocratic and wealthy. They owned a great deal of property. Gregory's parents inherited a considerable amount of land. But it was also a family that was very, very orthodox in faith. They had a deep commitment to Christianity over a number of generations. And I just mentioned the grandmother, St. Macrina the Elder, who was a follower of St. Gregory Thaumaturgos. And St. Macrina the Elder, she lived at a time when the persecutions were coming to a close, at the late 3rd century, early 4th century. And along with her family, she sought refuge for 7 years in the forest of Pontus. But unfortunately, the persecutions caught up with her, and she and her husband were killed during the last savage persecution in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. And now she's known as Saint Macrina the Elder. Gregory's parents, both now regarded as saints as well. His father, Basil, was from Neo Caesarea. He was a teacher, an eminent teacher of rhetoric in the city. Rhetoric was a highly valued discipline in those days. It was taught from ancient Greek times till, you know, during the Byzantine period as well. And it was basically the art of speaking and writing effectively, the art of self-expression and persuasion. It's not the kind of thing that's taught these days as a standalone discipline, but it was very important back then. But Gregory's father died when Gregory was only around 5 years old, and their mother, Emilia, took charge of the family. She was from Cappadocia. She was an orphan, and her preference was to remain celibate, to consecrate herself to virginity. But eventually she married out of fear of kidnapping. Apparently at that time it was quite common for girls who were unmarried to be kidnapped. I'm not exactly sure why, maybe because the kidnappers could get a ransom from this. I'm not exactly sure. But in any case, she needed a protector, and that's why she married. They had a large family, 5 boys and 5 girls. Three of the boys were to become bishops. 4 of the daughters married. Some of them did have children, and we know this because Basil dedicates one of his books to his nephews. And of the 5 girls, we know the name of only one of them, who is, of course, the most famous of all the daughters in the family, Macrina, and I'll come back to her in a minute. But I'll just start with the boys in the family, and the eldest brother of Gregory's was St. Basil. And because he was the eldest boy, he was the only one of Gregory's siblings who received a formal education. He studied at a school in Caesarea, which was the capital of Cappadocia. Then he went off for further studies in Constantinople. Then he did some further studies again in Athens, and it was in Athens where he met... where he formed a deep and lasting friendship with Gregory of Nazianzus, which lasted for some 30 years. Then Basil returned to Caesarea, where he took up teaching rhetoric. Then shortly after that, he retired from active life and took up a monastic life. Then he was to become a priest and eventually a bishop of Caesarea. And it was as a bishop of Caesarea that Basil became very well known and highly respected, not only in Cappadocia but in the Roman Empire at large. One of the things that he was very well known for was for his philanthropic work. He established a town on the outskirts of Caesarea where he cared for the poor and the sick, and this town was named after him. It was called the Basilia. But Basil had a tense relationship with his brother Gregory. He was not impressed with Gregory's inadequacies as a bishop. Another brother was St. Peter, the youngest in the family. Their father died soon after Peter was born, so Macrina took close care of him, and he was to become a bishop in what is now known as Armenia. Another brother was Naucratius. He rejected a brilliant career in rhetoric at the age of 21 to take up the life of a monk, and he dedicated himself to caring for the aged and sick. He also had a skill in hunting, and he would often go hunting to provide food for the old people that he was caring for. And unfortunately, during one of these hunting expeditions, he was killed by a wild boar. And this had a big effect on the family. Gregory describes this as, he calls this a grievous, tragic accident. It was enough to bring our whole family to misfortune and sorrow. So this, as this indicates, the family was a very close-knit family, a very affectionate and loving family. Saint Macrina, the eldest child of the family, who had a huge influence on the family and on Gregory especially. Gregory was to write her biography, and Gregory often calls her my teacher and my guide in his writings. And she was a truly amazing person. One scholar, Yaroslav Pelikan, calls her the fourth Cappadocian. And Pelikan was a very well-known scholar in the history of the church, and he actually converted to Orthodoxy in the last years of his life. Another scholar has called Macrina the Christian Socrates and a genius within a family of geniuses. But initially, she was actually engaged. Her parents had arranged an engagement for her, but her fiancé died, and so the marriage couldn't take place. But against her parents' wishes, she refused to accept a second engagement. She was determined to remain unmarried. When her father died, she helped her mother in raising her younger brothers and sisters, and she became the major pillar of strength for the family. She formed a very close bond with her mother, and after the death of their mother, she basically stepped in and took charge of the family. Eventually, she herself took up the monastic life, and she did this while her mother was still alive, actually. While her mother was still alive, she persuaded her mother to convert a property that the family had in a little town called Anissa. And I've got, you can see Anissa there. So it's about a day's journey from Neo-Caesarea. And Macrina convinced her mother to convert the family property in Anissa into a monastic community. And this was a community which consisted of men and women who worshipped together but who had living quarters in two separate buildings. So moving now to Gregory himself and his early years. At least initially, Gregory didn't show any great interest or commitment to the church. He remained unbaptized for many years. And it's said, however, that in his early years he was visited in a dream by the martyrs. The martyrs were those who were persecuted and died during the persecutions. The martyrs appeared to him and reproached him for his life of indifference. But this initially shocked him a bit, but it didn't have a lasting effect. So he just went on to study rhetoric. Though he didn't attend any of the great universities of the day, unlike his brother Basil, and he actually studied briefly under Basil when Basil was teaching rhetoric in Caesarea. And Basil must have done a very good job in training his younger brother, and it's surprising that despite lacking the formal training of Basil, Gregory moved more sympathetically than Basil did in the thought world of his day. Gregory was, in comparison to Basil, more sympathetic to and more influenced by Greek culture and especially philosophy. So once Basil left Caesarea, Gregory stayed on and undertook a more thorough and wide training in rhetoric and philosophy. And he even won the praise of the great Libanius for his rhetorical skills. Libanius was a very influential Greek sophist and rhetorician. The sophists were people who were professional orators who would tour the Eastern Mediterranean in an attempt to revive and celebrate ancient Greek learning and culture, and especially the ancient Greek ideals of virtue and heroism. So Gregory's youthful years coincided with this revival of pagan Greek culture, which reached its peak under the Emperor Julian the Apostate, who was a friend of Libanius's. And Libanius, though, was also also new and highly regarded individual Christians such as St. Basil and St. John Chrysostom. So around the age of 20, Gregory became an anagnostis in the church, a lector or a reader. He was also baptized about this time. And ordination as a lector was seen as a pathway towards ordination as a priest once you reach the canonical age of 30. But unexpectedly, Gregory didn't take this path. He didn't take the path of priesthood, nor did he take the path of the monastic life, as did his sister Macrina and his brother Basil. Instead, he took the path of a secular career as a teacher in rhetoric, and which of course was his father's profession as well. So he was following in his father's footsteps. And he was much in love with his chosen profession, but his family, and especially Macrina and Basil, were very worried about him. They were very concerned about the course his life was taking. And so they sought the help of Gregory Nazianzus. They asked him to intervene and to try to shake up Gregory and to instill some sense into him. And we've got one of the letters, fortunately, we've got one of the letters that Gregory Nazianzus wrote to Gregory of Nyssa, where he castigates him and criticizes him for the path he's chosen. And I'll just read you some passages from Gregory of Nazianzus' letter. It's a very strongly worded letter. He says, "What has happened to you, O wisest of men? And what do you condemn in yourself that you have tossed aside the sacred and delightful books which you once used to read to the people," that is, as his role as an anagnostis in the church, "and you have applied yourself to salty and bitter ones instead, preferring to be called a rhetorician rather than a Christian. Do not, excellent friend, do not continue on this path any longer, but though it is late, become sober again and return to yourself. Make your apology to the faithful and to God and to the altars and mysteries from which you have distanced yourself. And do not put me off in subtle rhetorical fashion. What, was I not a practicing Christian while a rhetorician, you ask? No, dear friend, not as you ought to have been." So Gregory of Nazianzus is making reference here to a question that Gregory of Nyssa must have asked him in an earlier letter, saying, well, wasn't I a Christian all this time that I've been practicing as a rhetorician? And Gregory of Nazianzus replies, no, you haven't been. Now, Gregory Nazianzus wasn't one to reject rhetoric. I mean, he was a famous rhetorician himself. But all he was saying to Gregory of Nyssa was that, look, practice rhetoric if you like, but do it within a Christian context, within a Christian way of life, within the Christian community. But despite this criticism from Gregory of Nazianzus, Gregory of Nyssa continued on his path for about 7 to 8 years. He continued in the profession of rhetoric until eventually he became a bishop. Probably around this time he married. His wife's name may have been Theosevia. There are some doubts about whether he married, but most scholars believe that Gregory did marry. They possibly had a son, and he remained married even after he became a bishop. And this practice was repudiated only later in the time of Justinian, the Emperor Justinian, in the 6th century. And it's possible that both his wife and his son died early. Eventually, Gregory gave up his career as a rhetorician and he went up to the monastic community that his sister had founded in Anissa, and he practiced there the ascetic life and studied theology. And among the authors he read at this time, Origen was the most influential on his mind. Now, the year 371 was a very important year in Gregory's life. It changed the course of his life. Now, just a bit of background, the emperor at this time was someone called Valens, who was the emperor of the eastern part of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire at this stage was divided into two parts, the west and the east, each with their own emperor. He was the Eastern Roman emperor, and he favoured Arianism. He was a supporter of Arianism. So Arianism was the heresy that Christ was not on the same level as God. Christ is not of the same essence, the same nature as God the Father. So according to the Arians, Christ is a creature a bit like us, but for the Arians, more exalted than human beings. So somewhere in between human beings and God. So they, Arians, in effect, rejected the doctrine of the Trinity. So Valens was a supporter of the Arian movement, which was a very influential movement at this time. And Valens wanted to diminish Orthodox authority. Now, when I say Orthodox in this context, I don't mean Orthodox as we use the term today in referring to the Orthodox Church. Orthodox in this context, as used by scholars when discussing this period, just means followers of the Nicene Creed, the creed that was promulgated by the Council of Nicaea in 325, which rejected Arianism and taught that the Son is of the same essence as the Father. So Valens wanted to diminish Orthodox authority, and to do that, what he employed a divide and conquer strategy. So he thought to himself, well, who is the most influential person amongst the Orthodox? At that time, it was Basil, who was Bishop of Caesarea, and he had jurisdiction over the region of Cappadocia. So Valens thought, well, he'll diminish Basil's authority by dividing Cappadocia into two, into a northern half and a southern half. And he'll allow Basil to continue working in the northern half, and he'll give the southern half over to an Arian bishop. So almost overnight, Basil's authority was halved, was split in two. Now, how did Basil respond to this? Well, he sought to retain control of the church in at least that new part of Cappadocia that Valens had created. And he tried to do this by installing as many Orthodox bishops in that new region of Cappadocia as he could. So he pressured his younger brother Gregory to become bishop of a small town called Nyssa, and he also pressured Gregory of Nazianzus to become bishop of another small town called Sasima. And these small towns were newly created bishoprics, newly created sees. And I've got a map here where you can see Nyssa. Okay. So Nyssa was a small town about 3 days' journey from Caesarea. And at least initially, Gregory really disliked the town and the people there. He didn't want to be there. And Basil was to accuse Gregory of simplicity and lack of experience in church administration. Gregory also faced opposition from heretics. And all this came to a head in the year 376 when a group of Arian bishops got together in Nyssa to try to depose Gregory, to get rid of him. And they brought two charges against him. One was to do with the way in which he was ordained as a bishop, and the other had to do with an alleged misappropriation of church funds. And these were pretty much trumped-up charges. The aim was to destabilise Basil's authority. But Basil was such a highly respected figure at this time that they could not touch Basil directly. So instead, they went after his brother. Now, although these were trumped-up charges, there was some validity behind the charge regarding the legitimacy of Gregory's ordination as a bishop, because the practice at this time was election by the people, and it's usually thought that if the inhabitants of Nyssa had a say in this, they would most likely have favoured an Arian bishop. In any case, the synod deposed Gregory. They installed someone else in his place, and Gregory was forced into exile. And for the next 2 years, Gregory wandered from place to place, depressed and sick in body and spirit. Where exactly he went, we don't really know. Basil states in one of his letters that Gregory was outside the borders of Cappadocia. We do know that he didn't go back to the property, the family property in Anissa, but where he did go, we don't really know. 378 was another important landmark in Gregory's life, because that was when the Emperor Valens was killed in a military battle. When Valens died, the Western Emperor appointed someone by the name of Theodosius to be Emperor of the East. And Theodosius was a very different kind of emperor from Valens. Theodosius was a devout Christian and an unequivocal supporter of Orthodoxy, the Nicene Confession. He saw himself as a kind of a continuation of the first Christian emperor, Constantine. And he even went so far as to make it illegal for people to worship the pagan gods. So once Valens died and was replaced by Theodosius, Gregory was allowed to return to Nyssa, and his congregation welcomed him back enthusiastically. And in one of his letters, Gregory writes that in the pouring rain, the people flocked to greet him so that he had trouble even getting out of his carriage. And I'll read you the excerpt from his letter where he talks about this. He says, "But as soon as we entered the portico, the carriage struck against the dry pavement. At that, as if by some signalling device, the people suddenly appeared, I know not from where or how. They thronged around us so closely that it was not easy to disembark from the carriage, for we could not find a spare space among them. But after we had with difficulty persuaded them to allow us a chance to descend and to let our mules pass through, we were pressed on every side by the crowd all around us, so much so that their excessive affection all but made us faint." So as this indicates, despite whatever failures he may have had as a church administrator, Gregory was greatly loved as a bishop and as a pastor amongst the ordinary people of his flock. Now, another great turning point in Gregory's life was the death of his brother, Basil. Now, this is traditionally thought to, traditionally dated to the 1st of January 379, though contemporary scholars now place his death in late September 378. And around this time also, his sister Macrina was very ill. Around the middle of 379, Gregory was away in Antioch attending a synod, a council. Then he made his way back to Nyssa, and when he got there, he got the news about Macrina's illness. And he hadn't seen his sister for nearly 8 years, and he was very keen to see her one more time before she died. So he made the trip to Anissa. It was about a 10-day journey, and he got there in time. He managed to see her before she died. He stayed by her side as she passed away, and he provides a very poignant account of her death in his biography of her. He says, "Once she died, my reason no longer maintained its proper balance, but as if submerged by some winter-swollen river in flood, I was swept away by sorrow, and disregarding the tasks at hand, gave myself over entirely to lamentation." Again, another indication of how close-knit and affectionate the family was. Gregory presided at her funeral, and he buried her in their parents' grave. So it was the death of Basil especially that was the big turning point in Gregory's life, because after Basil died, Gregory felt the responsibility for defending Orthodoxy against Arianism now fell on his shoulders. And so this began the most productive period in Gregory's life. After the death of Basil, Gregory engaged more and more in writing and in the vigorous administration of his diocese. And Gregory saw himself as Basil's heir. In the works that he wrote during this period, Gregory presented himself as the continuer of Basil's work. So during Basil's lifetime, Gregory felt restrained and wrote little. But after Basil's death, his literary and ecclesiastical activity flourished. Most of his writing belongs to the last 15 years of his life. So it seems that Basil's dominant personality had up till then prevented Gregory from fully expressing himself. A major event that Gregory took part in the latter part of his life was the Ecumenical Council of 381 in Constantinople. This is now known as an ecumenical council, the second ecumenical council of the church, even though there was little representation there from Rome or Western bishops. And the Emperor Theodosius pretty much convened this as an Eastern council because his overriding concern was to unite the Eastern part of the church at the end of the lengthy Arian controversy. So the church at that time was battling a number of heresies, especially the Arian heresy, which were threatening the unity of the church. And in a famous passage in one of Gregory's writings, which I've put up here, Gregory describes this passion for controversy which existed back then and which he saw not only amongst the priests and the bishops or the scholars and theologians, but everybody got involved in theological debates back then. And he writes, in this city, in Constantinople, when you ask someone for change, he will discuss with you whether the son is begotten or unbegotten. If you ask someone for the price of a loaf of bread, he will answer, the father is greater and the son is subordinate. If you suggest that you require a bath, you will be told, there was nothing before the son was created. So, and these were Arian views. So the council was attended by something like 200 bishops, and they included some of Christianity's greatest figures of the time, including Gregory of Nazianzus, Jerome, Evagrius Ponticus, John Chrysostom, and Cyril of Jerusalem. And Gregory himself was also there. We don't know too much about his activities in the council, but his abilities and orthodoxy must have made a deep impression on both the emperor and the other fathers, because he was chosen to do a number of things. He was chosen to preach the opening address of the council, at least according to some scholars. He was chosen to deliver the funeral oration of Bishop Meletius of Antioch. Bishop Meletius was the president of the council, and he passed away during the course of the council. And at the end of the council, Gregory was also chosen to be one of the promoters of orthodoxy in the province of Pontus. Another indication of the high esteem in which Gregory was held is the fact that he was chosen to deliver the funeral orations for members of the imperial family. So this indicates the great reputation he enjoyed at this time as an orator. In August 385, he delivered the funeral oration for the princess who died 6 years of age, and she was the only child of Theodosius. And later in the year, in October, he also delivered the funeral address of the empress 30 days after her death. So this was a time around the years 380 to 385 when Gregory's influence was at its peak. It was a time when Gregory played a prominent role as a consultant theologian in the Church of the Eastern Empire, and he participated in various councils in Constantinople, not only the one in 381, but others as well. He also undertook various tasks as an envoy or representative of the church. He was sent on a special mission to the churches to reform the churches of Arabia, and the emperor provided him with facilities for the journey. When he returned from Arabia, he visited Jerusalem and the holy places, and he was invited to go there as a mediator between conflicting parties. But unfortunately, instead of calming the local disputes, he provoked new ones, as he himself was accused of heresy. And so he left Jerusalem quite disheartened, and he says in one of his letters that he left Jerusalem with a sad face. In the last decade of his life, he retired from public life. He removed himself from theological debates and administrative duties, And he gave himself over entirely to the spiritual life. He left Constantinople and went back to the monastic community in Anissa that his sister had founded. And he died sometime around 394 and 400. So that's a bit about his life. Not the most eventful life, at least when you compare it to, say, someone like Gregory of Nazianzus or even his brother Basil or John Chrysostom. But nevertheless, what Gregory is most well known for is his theology, his writings. And so I'll say something about that now. And I'll only mention some of his writings, not all of them. And the most important of his theological works is the first one I've got up here, Against Evnomius. Evnomius was an Arian, and this book is that Gregory wrote. It's a four-volume work he wrote over 3 years, and it's a refutation of Arianism. And Basil had done something similar against the Arians, and when Basil passed away, Gregory thought of himself as the heir of Basil in terms of fighting the Arian heresy. Now, just to understand this debate, I'll say something about Evnomius, who was a leader of the Arians at this stage. Arius had passed away. He died sometime around the birth of Gregory. But the Arian movement was still strong, and the leader of the Arians at this time was Evnomius. He became a bishop in the year 360, but he was soon deposed, only after a few months, because of his teachings. And his teachings were attacked by Basil and were finally condemned by the Council of Constantinople in 381. And what Evnomius was best known for was his rational abilities. He had a thirst for knowledge, he had a remarkable powers of reason, and he's often perceived, even by scholars today, as a rationalist, as a logic chopper. He had a dislike for mysticism, so he was a very different kind of person from Gregory. And like all Arians, Evnomius taught that Christ was not on the same level as God the Father, that God the Father is of a different essence from God the Son. And the way Evnomius put this was to say that God, by which he meant the Father or the Creator, is in essence unbegotten, agenitos in Greek. But Christ is begotten of the Father, so the Son possesses a different essence from the Father. And so for Evnomius, unbegotten, agenesia, defines the essence of God. So Evnomius thought that we can know in a precise and complete way the essence of God, who God is, because God is by essence agenitos, according to Evnomius. And this sounds like an arrogant intellectualist claim. In fact, in a famous saying that was attributed to Evnomius, Evnomius is thought to have said, God does not know more about his own essence than we do. So we know as much about God as God does about himself. So it's a crazy idea. How did Gregory respond to this? Well, Gregory emphasized that God, in essence, is unknowable, incomprehensible. When, according to Gregory, when we are speaking of God's inner nature or essence, all that we can say is what God is not. We can say God is not in time, God is not in space, God is not someone who changes, God is not bad, not evil. So these negations, these negative predicates we ascribe to God, give rise to what's called negative theology, apophatic theology. It's a way of protecting the mystery of God. But then if that's the case, what can we know of God and how can we experience God or interact with God? Gregory's answer was to make a distinction between God's essence and God's energies. And this is a distinction which has had a huge influence in patristic theology and especially in the writings of the 14th century theologian St. Gregory Palamas. So the idea is this, that by God's essence, we mean God as he is known to himself. And this is completely inaccessible to us. But God's energies, or energias, are the operations and actions of God in the world, or the ways in which God manifests himself in his creation. And it's through God's energies that we can come to know and experience God. Okay, moving now to some other writings of Gregory's. In a short book, more like a letter that he addressed to a younger bishop called Ablabius, and now it's known by the title That There Are Not Three Gods, Gregory provides a defense and clarification of the doctrine of the Trinity. He wrote this sometime around the Council of 381, and he deals there with what he himself calls an extraordinary dilemma. Okay, and this is how he put the dilemma. Think of three human beings, let's say Peter, James, and John. They all share a single nature, humanity, and so they can be called three men. Now, by analogy, think of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They share a single nature, divinity, so why can't they be called three gods? If Peter, James, and John can be called three men, why can't Father, Son, and Spirit be called three gods? And that's the dilemma that Gregory grapples with and tries to resolve in this short treatise. It's a short, very short treatise, but it's had a huge influence. Another book that's been very influential is a dialogue on the soul and the resurrection. This was written around 380, 381. And it's a dialogue that is intentionally based on Plato's famous dialogue, the Phaedo, where Plato talks about the death of Socrates. And Gregory's dialogue has been called the Christian Phaedo. And in the Phaedo, in Plato's Phaedo, Socrates has been condemned to death for corrupting the youth and not believing in the gods of Greece. And he comforts his grieving disciples by affirming the immortality of the soul and explaining why he as a philosopher can be calm in the face of his death sentence. And in Gregory's dialogue, Macrina plays the role of Socrates. The conversation is set shortly after Basil's death, when Gregory had returned to Anissa to see his sister, and she was dying, and the dialogue unfolds on the day before her death. And it's likely that the work was written soon after her death. It's been translated into English. I've got a copy of it here. It's a short book. It's very, very interesting. It consists of 10 short chapters dealing with a range of themes, mainly on the nature of the soul, the origin of the soul. And Gregory focuses on the idea of the resurrection of the body. And he tries to respond to various objections that pagan philosophers were making against this doctrine of the resurrection of the body. Another very influential book, also available in English translation, it's part of the Classics of Western Spirituality series, is The Life of Moses. This is one of Gregory's last works, written in the early 390s. And here Gregory talks about the Old Testament journey of the Hebrews from Egypt to Mount Sinai. And he sees this as a pattern, as an allegory for the progress of the soul through the temptations of the world to the vision of God. So it's here that he develops his famous theme of perfection as consisting in endless progress, eternal, infinite progress. In Greek, the word is epektasis. I'll come back to this a bit later. Gregory was influenced, you can see the influence in this work from people like Plato, Philo, who was a Jew from Alexandria who lived in the round about Jesus' time. Philo himself wrote a two-part Life of Moses. But the greatest influence is Origen, especially Origen's homilies on the book of Exodus. So Gregory divides the book into two parts. The first part he calls the historia, a history, where he summarizes or paraphrases the actual life of Moses as recorded in the books of Exodus and Numbers. And here he sticks to the literal interpretation of Scripture. The second part, which is the by far the more interesting part, he calls the theoria, contemplation. And here he doesn't restrict himself to a literal interpretation, but he develops a non-literal, allegorical interpretation. So he uses the allegorical method that people like Philo of Alexandria and Origen had developed. So the allegorical method tries to uncover the spiritual meaning, the deeper meaning, the hidden sense of the scriptural narrative. And Gregory presents Moses here as a symbol for the mystic migration and ascension of the soul to God. So what's interesting about this is that Gregory doesn't restrict himself to a literal interpretation, and you see this in the fathers generally and in the Orthodox tradition more broadly, that the Bible isn't read in a purely literalist or fundamentalist way. Non-literalist interpretations are allowed. And in fact, Gregory says that a literal interpretation should be used only when it's useful. And what he meant by that is only when it's useful in promoting virtue or in aiding in your salvation. If a literal interpretation does not help in that way, then you should discard it and go for a non-literal interpretation. Now, this theme of perfection as eternal progress, infinite progress, it rests on an idea that Gregory is best known for, and it was his most revolutionary contribution to theology of the time. And this is the idea of infinity. So, in Latin, infinity literally means no end or no boundary. In Greek, the word is to apiron, which means something that has no peras, and peras is usually translated as no limits or no boundary. So peras is usually translated as limits or bound. So to apiron translates as the unlimited or unbounded, the infinite. And from the dawn of civilization, infinity has held a special fascination. People have been captivated by the seeming boundlessness of time and space. We are fascinated by the mystery of numbers that seem to go on and on infinitely long. Even in mathematics, the idea of infinity was seen as something that was not capable of formalization in mathematical terms till the 19th century, and when transfinite arithmetic was developed. And even today, mathematicians are skeptical whether mathematical sense can be made of the notion of infinity. Infinity has also given rise to various paradoxes, antinomies, and contradictions. And the famous 18th century German philosopher, Immanuel Kant, the philosopher of the Enlightenment, said that the infinite lies beyond the reach of human reason. It lies beyond human understanding. And for Kant, infinity is a source of various insoluble antinomies. And it was this idea that was the heart of Kant's philosophy. Now, questions involving the notion of infinity arose very early in the history of Western philosophy and science. And you see this in early Greek philosophy, where philosophers asked questions like, is the world infinite? Is time infinite? Does the notion of infinity even make sense? Can it be expressed in a coherent way? But generally, the Greeks had a very negative view of infinity. And there's a saying, a famous saying, which goes that the Greeks abhorred the infinite. So in classical Greek philosophy, infinity represented something that was seen as formless, characterless, indeterminate, and unintelligible chaos. Infinity was a pejorative word. So something is good to the extent that it is limited by form, and it is bad or defective or even evil to the extent that it is unlimited or infinite. And you see this in various ancient Greek philosophers, and I'll just mention two here, Pythagoras and Plato. Pythagoras, who lived in the 6th century BC, founded a religious society in southern Italy, and in his view of the world, there are two basic cosmological principles, two basic forces in the world. One is he called toperas, which was understandable and good. The other he called to apiron, which he said is a dark and boundless void beyond the visible heavens. And because it has no end in the sense of a limit, a peras, it also has no end in the sense of a purpose or a reason. So it's no peras equals no telos. So apiron for Pythagoras is something that's senseless, chaotic, indeterminate, and without structure. It is simply waiting to have a peras imposed on it. And when the peras is imposed on the apiron, what you get is a cosmos, a world. But what the ancient Greeks meant by world is something that is a beautifully structured, harmonious whole, whose parts are held together in a unity precisely because of their limited and finite nature. Now, a similar view of infinity was held by Plato. What's Plato's most famous teaching? The theory of the forms. So Plato thought that the physical world, the world that we see and experience on a day-to-day basis, is full of change and imperfection. And so he thought there must be another world, one that is more perfect and changeless and eternal, made up of what he called the forms. And the forms are things or entities that are invisible, changeless, eternal, and separate from the world of our senses. So, for example, the various good things that we see and experience on a daily basis are, according to Plato, merely pale and imperfect reflections of true goodness, which is the form of the good. So for Plato, absence of form, absence of limits, indicates failure or evil, whereas everything that is ultimately good belongs to the real world, the world of the forms. So for Plato, there is a lingering Pythagorean resistance to the idea that there could be anything infinite about what was real and true and good. Now, Gregory revolutionized all this. He thought, he gave a very positive interpretation of infinity. He saw infinity as something positive, even a perfection, and he ascribed infinity to God. And in doing this, he was going against tradition. He was going against the received wisdom, not only of the ancient Greeks, but of theologians like Origen, who agreed with Plato that the absence of limit and form is a defect. And Gregory tied the idea of the infinity of God to his apophatic theology. So Gregory thought that God is unknowable, incomprehensible, because God is infinite. Now, Gregory wasn't the first to think of this. There are some precedents. Philo of Alexandria had a similar view. But what you find in Gregory is a strong and probably one of the strongest emphases on infinity amongst Christian theologians. And unlike Evnomius, Gregory thought that it is infinity and not unbegottenness, not agenesia, that is the key attribute or trait of God. And this was a radical new way of thinking about God. It was also a scandalizing move, given the inherently negative attitude of the Greeks towards infinity. Infinity was seen as betraying a lack of form, a lack of order, a lack of harmony. And I've got some quotes here where Gregory talks about infinity in his book Against Evnomius. And he states that we cannot fully know God, and he justifies this by arguing that finite human reason cannot comprehend the infinite God. So he says in the first quote I've got there, human nature has not the capacity in it to understand precisely the being of God. And the reason for this is explained in terms of the gap between the infinite creator and finite creation. So Gregory says in the second quote, the barrier which separates uncreated nature from created being is great and impenetrable. One is finite, the other infinite. The one is confined within its proper measure as the wisdom of its maker determined. The limit of the other is infinity. The one stretches out immeasurable extension, being bounded by time and space. The other transcends any notion of measure, eluding investigation however far one casts the mind. So one implication of or meaning of infinity is transcending measure or extension in time and space. In this life, one may perceive both a beginning and an end of what exists, but the blessedness transcending creation approaches neither beginning nor end, but is by nature beyond the meaning of both. So to transcend time means something like having no beginning or end. In another very famous passage, Gregory speaks of the divine nature as being unbounded temporally and spatially. And he compares it to the ocean, the wide open expanse of the ocean. And he says, having traversed the ages and all that has been produced therein, our thought catches a glimpse of the divine nature as of some immense ocean. But when the imagination stretches onward to grasp it, it gives no sign in its own case of any beginning. So there's an allusion here that he's making to the notion of epectasis, which I'll come back to in a minute. He says, the imagination stretches onward to grasp it, the divine nature. The human mind tries to grasp the divine nature, but what it seeks moves forward and is never reached. The analogy he draws with the ocean is one that you also find in Gregory of Nazianzus and in St. John of Damascus. And John of Damascus, in a book entitled On Right Thinking, makes the following profession of faith. He says, I believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who are one God, one principle of all, one super divine divinity, one super entitative entity, mia hyperousios ousia, one super good goodness, an ocean of infinite and boundless being, pelagos ousias apiro ke apiroristo. And in another very famous quote, John of Damascus says, and this is something that Gregory himself could have written, the divinity is both infinite and incomprehensible, and this alone is comprehensible about him, his very infinity and incomprehensibility. Now, an important notion that Gregory uses to explain the idea of infinity is the notion of diastema, which just means an extension in time and space. So what Gregory says is that the created world is characterized by diastema. It is extended in time and space. But God has no diastema. God is referred to as adiastatos and proaeonios, meaning transcending the aeones, the ages. So God cannot be measured by time or by the ages. So infinity for Gregory means having no beginning or end. And God is infinite because God possesses it. God is not extended in time. God has no beginning or end. Okay, another important contribution that Gregory made was to the doctrine of the Trinity. And this, of course, is the belief that God is a Trinity of three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. God is one and God is three. So God as the ancient Israelites taught is radically one, a single reality, a single substance, or sia, or a single nature, a physis. But God in Christianity is also three persons, three prosopa, or three hypostases. But when we say three persons, three prosopa, we don't mean persons in the modern day sense of person as someone who has their own personality, their own individuality, their own will. So maybe a better term is hypostasis, which is a difficult term to explain. Literally, it means that which stands under, hypostasis, that which lies underneath. And in ancient Greek philosophy, it was used to mean that which has a concrete, full reality, a real existence, as opposed to something that's merely fictional or a delusion or something of that sort. So the Cappadocian settlement to the various controversies regarding the doctrine of the Trinity was to clarify the doctrine by talking about God as having one ousia in three hypostases. That was the Cappadocian contribution, which Gregory himself was part of. This is not a version of polytheism or tritheism. It's not belief in three gods, nor is it modalism or Sabellianism after the heretic Sabellius, who taught that the three persons are just varying modes or aspects of God, the kind of masks that God can put on and off. So the Cappadocian contribution was to talk of God as having one ousia in three hypostases, and this brought a new conceptual precision to Trinitarian thought. It refined the idea from the Council of Nicaea that the Son is of one substance, homoousios, with the Father, and it did so by distinguishing the divine unity of essence, the ousia, and its three persons, the hypostases. But the Cappadocians also moved beyond the issue of the divinity of the Son to discuss and affirm the divinity of the Holy Spirit. And what lies behind these debates is a problem that the ancient Greeks called the problem of the one and the many. Which is more important, which is superior or has greater value, the one or the many? And Greek philosophy from the time of Parmenides in the 6th century BC held that singleness or simplicity is always prior to and preferable to multiplicity. So they almost always preferred the one over the many. But the Cappadocians turned this around and they gave priority to the many, or at least put the many on the same level as the one. And this in some ways is a kind of prefigures certain strands in contemporary philosophy, including postmodern philosophy, where the many is given priority over the one. So in postmodern philosophers like Gilles Deleuze, a French philosopher, ultimate reality is seen as consisting in diversity, not in unity or sameness. Okay, I've mentioned the idea of epectasis a few times, so I'll now say something more about it. Literally, the word epectasis means a tension, a stretching out, expansion. And Gregory developed this into a very important idea that plays a very important role in his theology, and it's had a huge influence over other theologians. So Gregory pictures the soul as engaged in a perpetual progress or striving. The soul continually stretches out towards God. There's a process of infinite growth. And Gregory draws in part from Scripture on this. He likes quoting Philippians, a passage in the Apostle Paul's letter to the Philippians, where the Apostle says, "Forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead." Straining forward is a translation of epectinomenos. There are parallels also in Origen and Augustine. Now, the basic idea is that And Gregory bases this view on his idea of the infinity of God. And he says, because God is infinite, and because the most natural human drive is to long for, to desire God, no creature can truly exhaust its progress in communion with God. And on the life of Moses, he says, since then those who know what is good by nature desire participation in it, and since this good has no limits, the participant's desire itself has no stopping place, but stretches out with the limitless, stretches out, is epectasis. So Gregory pictures the human soul as rising ever higher and higher, always reviving its tension for its onward flight by means of the progress it has already realized. And he pictures the afterlife as an endless exploration of the infinite riches of God. And in a wonderful passage in the dialogue on the soul and the resurrection, he has Macrina say, love alone finds no limits. Now, the originality in all this is the idea that perfection presupposes change. This was a groundbreaking idea, because the general assumption back then amongst Platonist philosophy, Platonism was the philosophy of the day back then, and the general assumption was that perfection is something that has to be static and changeless. Any change can only be a move away from or a move towards perfection, and so a perfect being has no need for change. But Gregory argued against this. And in one of his books, he says, true perfection never stands still, but is always growing toward the better. Perfection is limited by no boundaries. So for Gregory, if we refuse to change, that is not a sign of our virtue or our perfection, but it is a sign of our sinfulness. So Gregory's originality lies in the way in which he values change, openness, and dynamism as essential characteristics of the human condition. And it's change that he sees as what distinguishes us from God. Now, this is very different from, you know, the general view of the time amongst Platonist philosophers, who thought that change is a defect. And so if you remember with Plato, the world of the forms is a world of things that are changeless, eternal, and change is seen as a degeneration from a state of perfection. And this is also different from the Roman Catholic notion of the beatific vision, which you find in Thomas Aquinas. According to Aquinas, heaven is experienced in a timeless moment, an eternal now of divine illumination. But for Gregory, heaven is an everlasting exploration by finite creatures of the infinite riches of the divine reality. And I've got up there a picture of the cover of this book, From Glory to Glory, which was edited by Jean Danielu, a Jesuit, who put together an anthology of Gregory's major mystical and spiritual writings. And one of the big themes that comes out in this book is Gregory's notion of epectasis. So it's worth having a look at this if you get a chance. Now, finally, one last major theme in Gregory's theology is the theme of salvation. And according to some scholars, Gregory endorses what's called universalism, which is the belief that all people will in the end live eternally with God, that all persons eventually will be saved. So if people do go to hell, they will not be there forever. Another way to put this is to say that God's love is so great and God's grace so attractive that eventually everyone will finally say yes to God's offer of salvation and will be saved. So this is universal salvation, even of the devil. Now, Gregory uses the word apokatastasis, which means a final restoration or reconstitution. And it's a restoration of humanity to its original state of communion with God, or the return of the human being to paradise. Now, universalism was something that was explicitly taught by Origen, but it's not clear whether Gregory actually accepted this idea. There are some passages, like these two, where he seems to endorse universalism. This is from a book that I haven't mentioned. It's called The Catechetical Oration. It's one of Gregory's major books where he gives a systematic analysis of the principal doctrines of the Christian faith. In the first quote, he says, "When over long periods of time, it, that is evil, has been removed, and those now lying in sin have been restored to the original state, all creation will join in united thanksgiving, both those whose purification has involved punishment and those who never needed purification at all." And a bit later he says, "God freed man from evil," and here he's talking about the incarnation, "and healed even the introducer of evil himself." And he seems to be referring to Satan there, but he doesn't say so explicitly. And there are other passages in other works where he sort of points to, in a similar way, to universalism. In the Dialogue on the Soul and the Resurrection, for example, he says that, well, he pictures those who die in their sins as having to go through a process of purification, of healing in the afterlife, and when eventually there will be no evil at all. Evil will be completely obliterated at the end of time. But still, it's not entirely clear whether Gregory did accept universalism. And there are a few relevant facts here that we need to bear in mind. One is that Gregory, unlike Origen, was never formally condemned for his doctrine of apokatastasis. Origen's doctrine was condemned at a council in Constantinople in 543, but Gregory was never condemned. Another relevant fact is when you look at the way subsequent fathers interpreted Gregory's doctrine, you see them that the way they understood Gregory, they did not think that Gregory was endorsing universalism. So, for example, Maximus the Confessor, he says that to properly understand Gregory, you need to make a distinction between knowledge of divine goods and participation in divine goods. And according to Maximus, what Gregory meant was that at the end of time, everyone will have access to knowledge of goods, of the divine goods, but not everyone will participate in them, and therein lies their damnation or their condemnation. And so this might well be right as an interpretation of Gregory. Another relevant fact is that Gregory, in other parts of his works, explicitly affirms the eternity of hell. And finally, another important fact to take into account is that Gregory is someone who places great value on human free will. He, in fact, sees human free will, liberty, as that which constitutes the divine image in human beings. So he sees free will as that which makes us godlike and remains with us even after the initial fall. So free will is that which constitutes the very being of the human being. And this is why Gregory was one of the most outspoken people of his time against the practice of slavery. He thought of human slavery as denigrating the dignity of humanity. But if Gregory believes so much in free will, then he couldn't possibly accept universalism, because if you accept universalism, then God would have to override human free will in order to guarantee that everyone is saved. If people are genuinely free, then whether they're saved or not will depend on their choice. And so God cannot unilaterally guarantee that everybody will be saved if people have free will. Okay, on that note, I'll finish up, and I hope this has given you a bit of a better understanding and appreciation of Gregory's life and theology, and hopefully it will also motivate you to look up some of Gregory's works and have a look at them and engage with them yourself. So Thank you.
The main question I had, when you were talking about, I think, with Gregory, travelling between places earlier on, what mode of transport, like when you say 3 days or 10 days or...
I think just by horse carriage.
Okay, I wasn't sure with that or foot.
Thank you, Nick. A quick question. When St. Gregory was speaking about the popular discussion of contentious theological issues, he goes and buys some bread and they talk about theological issues, and he goes for a walk and they talk about theology. Is he speaking in a positive or in a negative way towards this popular discussion, or is it it's an open comment? So, for example, because St. Gregory the theologian says in his oration that the discussion of theology isn't for the pub, isn't for sporting events. It's not for everyone. So is St. Gregory of Nyssa, is he presenting that as a negative? Because I'm guessing he wouldn't have bought his own bread. He would have had servants to buy his own bread. So he's making an observation on the discussion of theology.
Oh, you mean that quote that I...
At the beginning, the long quote,
about the people in Constantinople always... I don't know. I can't remember the context of what else he had to say. But he definitely found it intimidating. When he came from, Neo-Caesarea was a fairly large city at the time, but doesn't compare to Constantinople. And he will not have been exposed to that level, that kind of level of passionate theological debates. So I guess he felt intimidated. Whether he thought it was inappropriate, I'm not sure. It was a fact of life back then. A bit like the way people now, everybody discusses things like the new atheism of Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, or evolution. That's what people talk about now. We don't talk about, Trinitarian debates. But still, people do get involved in these discussions.
You should go to Coles just down in South Melbourne. That's all the cashiers talk about, the Trinity. If I can ask a question, Nick, you mentioned St. Gregory of Nyssa spoke and wrote about the infinity of God. And I noticed you didn't use the word eternity. Is there a distinction that he's meaning?
No, one of the definitions he uses for infinity is eternity.
Right.
Eternity in the sense of having no extension in time, having no beginning, no end.
So outside the realm of time.
So just one clarification on that. So you're saying infinity and eternity are interchangeable?
To some extent. I don't think he would identify the two. I think infinity would mean more than just eternity, but it means at least that. So infinity means eternity, but it also means more than just that.
How far do you go exactly? Because that's the philosophical side, infinity.
Well, look, lying at the background here is a theological debate, debate that Gregory was having with the Arians. What he wanted to counter was the Arian view that the Son, Christ, had a beginning in time.
They're quoting Pythagoras, and of course our mathematical formulas are coming from Pythagoras. And then, so again, you've got this philosophy academia in comparison to academia religion. Anyway, I'll let it go.
But that's a distinction that wasn't really made back then. Gregory was, if you read this, you'll see how influenced he was by Plato, and he's always talking about what the ancient Greeks had to say, not agreeing with them, but it's always there in the background. That was the world he lived in. He couldn't get away from it. Not that he just took it on board. He was very critical of certain aspects of it. But theology at this time was very much influenced by ancient Greek philosophy, and it was a way of what the fathers were trying to do was to, in a way, baptize Greek philosophy in Christianity, transform it.
I just want to clarify, when you said that he was in exile, I'm not sure if I understood it correctly, because sometimes English language is ambiguous, or I may interpret it differently. But does that mean he was actually ousted from his country at the time, from his some of his... What was it that people...
Well, I guess he would have been exiled from Cappadocia. And that's why Basil mentioned in his letter that Gregory lies outside the borders of Cappadocia. Where he went, nobody really knows.
Oh, so being in exile means that you kind of disappear for a while. Is that what it...
Well, he was actually forcefully removed.
Oh, okay.
He was actually... The emperor forced him to leave Cappadocia. He had to leave.
Oh.
And so he remained pretty much in hiding for those 2 years.
And then, obviously, he was welcomed back.
When the emperor died, yeah.
When the emperor died. Oh, okay. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying that.
Sorry, I might have missed something, but I'm still confused about... Can you clarify his position on universalism versus free will?
His position? Or what the conflict is?
No, but how does he... I reckon free will. We all got free will. It's plain to me.
How does he
come down on that?
I don't know. It's ambiguous. That's the problem. It's not clear.
That's a critical issue.
Well, the problem is it's not clear whether he accepted universalism or not. It's not clear. You read one passage, it seems to say one thing. Then you go to another book, it seems to say something else. It's open for debate. But it seems to contradict what he says about free will. That's the problem.
That is critical. I mean, so how does the church come on? He's a big... I mean,
well, as far as I'm aware, the church has never endorsed universalism.
Okay.
So, but the problem is Gregory also was never condemned formally. I guess the belief of the church is a hope that everyone is saved, but it's not something we can actually proclaim as doctrine.
Nick, I was just going to say, with that universalism and free will, or the concept, and I haven't read anything about Gregory or whatever, but the whole thing about universalism, if it means that everyone is going to be saved regardless of what they do in this life, isn't that the whole point of free will? If you've got that, if you do this or you commit sin, you'll go to hell, etc., etc., how is that really free will if there's going to be punishment at the end of it? So in a sense, there's this rope hanging over your head and it's not realistically free will. And I think the whole concept of universalism might fall on that, that if everyone does go to the same place, then ultimately that's free will in a sense. I don't know. Yeah. And that's probably
where the debate is. I guess those who reject universalism would say that, well, if you have genuine free will, then it must always be possible for you to say no to God. Okay? According to universalism, that is not a real possibility. It might be in some abstract sense possible, but in the end, it's guaranteed everyone will be saved. That's what universalism says. That's what the idea of universalism says, yes.
He has to repent, even devil, to be saved.
Well, Gregory does talk about those who die in sin having to undergo a lengthy and painful process of healing.
Not for longer, just a length.
Well, he does say, I can't remember the exact word, but something to the effect of it is extremely long for some people. Something along those lines.
So not forever.
Well, no, not forever.
So if everybody is going to be saved and live with God, so that means not forever. It's the punishment.
That's right. But, you know, again, there are other parts in Gregory's works where he affirms the eternity of hell. So...
Nick, I've been taught pretty much anything ends in ism, which is be very skeptical of it. That's what I've been taught. So anything has that ism.
What's that, sorry?
The ism word on the end. So it's
called ism. You're right, yeah. Right.
So it just rings bells in my ears every time I look at something, that word just sort of sends messages that says, don't believe in it. I don't know, that's just me.
Oh, well, it's just a convenient term, that's all.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nick. thanks for your talk. I've actually got two questions, if that's okay.
Yep.
One of them was when you mentioned about earlier on in the church when there was a bishop who was part of the Arianism movement and he believed in Arianism.
Yeah, of Nomius.
Of Nomius. And also the emperor that ended up dying and then Gregory came back.
Yeah.
And then he split the church into Cappadocia, into east and west.
Yeah,
north and south. So did that part of the church believe in Arianism at that time when that emperor was?
There were large parts of the Roman Empire, especially in the east, that favoured Arianism. Arianism was very popular in the east, not so much in the west.
So when you say east, do you mean the Eastern Orthodoxy of Cappadocia?
Geographically, so Asia Minor especially, what is modern-day Turkey, areas like Cappadocia, the Pontus.
So there were actual Orthodox bishops at the time that were favouring?
Well, they were bishops, they weren't Orthodox. So the east was pretty much this area. That was the Eastern Roman Empire. I'm not sure if modern-day Greece would have been classified as part of the East, but the rest was Asia Minor. To be Orthodox at that time meant to follow the Nicene Creed, the Creed of the Council of Nicaea, which professed that the Son is of the same substance as the Father, so it's the doctrine of the Trinity. The Arians rejected that. So there were two major parties, the Arians and the Orthodox. Okay, and many emperors in the East favoured Arianism, and that was the problem. Until Theodosius. Theodosius was one of the first emperors who favoured the Orthodox.
And the other question was in relation to universalism,
yep.
Where with the statement about healing... Yeah, that where it says, and healed even the introducer of evil himself.
Yeah.
Could he have meant there either Adam or Eve?
Could have, yeah. It's open to interpretation. I'd have to go back and read that passage again, but from memory, it's very brief. He doesn't elaborate, and he just leaves it at that. And it's kind of just left open for interpretation. And that's the problem.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for your talk tonight. It was very informative. Going back on the topic with universalism, it's a very touchy topic. I suppose it's more of a comment. What I want to say is, I suppose the universalism, I'm just wondering how that was allowed to St. Gregory's... suppose theory on universalism was allowed to proceed in the doctrine by the church fathers, and I suppose
partly because he had the authority of Origen behind it. Origen accepted universalism, and Origen was very influential. And Origen had a very complicated theological system which explained how everybody was saved in the end. Partly explains.
So wouldn't the concept of universalism actually deny the cross? Because what was the whole point of Jesus coming as God incarnate to die on a cross for our sins? So obviously that opposes the whole theory of universalism.
I'm not defending universalism.
Yeah.
I'm just explaining an idea that defines Gregory's works. And Gregory doesn't address that, but from my experience in reading and speaking to people who do accept universalism, they say things like, well, in becoming human, Christ offers salvation to everyone. He provides a path for everyone to be saved. Something along those lines. Whether that's convincing is another question.
As a saint, he's actually, I don't know because I'm not the specialist. I mean, you people are. He's sitting on a border. He's neither saying one nor the other.
Well, it's not clear. That's the problem.
And I mean, to be quoting these things, that this is what they're saying to the layperson like us, and as Panaj is just saying, it's actually very, very, it's scary because it is saying that we're all going to be saved. It's, you know, we can do whatever. I'm not saying for us now. I'm just thinking in Islam and Judaism, I wonder if these are the things that, not so much that they don't look at these, but then you've got these other, as Nick was saying, these other New Age religions with the isms at the end of them that they say be wary, that these are sort of the paradoxes that they're looking at, these philosophies through the ancient Greeks and the modern Greeks. I don't know, but
well, that's the reality of the fathers. You read the works of the fathers, you know, they say all sorts of things. You've got to, if you're going to really engage with the writings of the fathers, you've got to be prepared to find things in there that you might not like.
I'm not sure which fathers, though, not the fathers that...
Gregory of Nyssa on...
You're talking of these particular ones. Okay, fair enough.
Gregory was not infallible. He might have made a mistake here. He might have actually accepted universalism in the being under the influence of Origen, and he might have made a mistake. That's
to be very powerful.
He was a very powerful influence. Very
powerful.
Yeah. He was a very powerful influence over a whole generation of theologians. It's possible that Gregory was misled on this issue.
Nick, it seems like this was his thought process
at
that time.
Yes.
Then the church and other theologians and the other ecumenical councils would have moved on from that, because we're not stuck on this now.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's what we need to say is... Where are we at now?
That's right. That's
where
right.
is the Orthodox Church now?
Yes.
It's not that.
The Church has never accepted this.
Exactly. And I think you need to do it. And, mate, give us the... All right, go through all those and say, what do we believe in now? So that everyone will be clear.
Right. Yes.
Because we're sort of...
That's right.
To anyone who's new tonight, who's doing the thought process of what St. Gregory of Nyssa has done that, might go and say, hey, I've been taught something different and be confused.
That's right.
So maybe if you can go, where are we at now in... St. Evstathios Church now.
That's right.
Yeah, go on. Because that was a thought process then, but we're not at that now.
No, I mean, this was never... on the one hand, it was never condemned by the Church.
We moved on. We've moved on and clarified.
Yeah. Origen was condemned for teaching this. So that's important. Origen was condemned for teaching the final and universal salvation of everyone. Okay, so that shows that the Church has not accepted this.
Yeah, and the Roman Catholic Church still accepts purgatory, but we don't. We have repentance, confession, repentance, and
I don't think they accept universalism either.
Yeah.
I don't think they accept universalism, even though they accept purgatory. I think the problem, what happens with Gregory is that he's such a huge figure as a theologian, he's such a saintly person, that the Church did not want to condemn him just for this issue.
Yeah.
They thought,
contemporaries, how does St. Basil the Great, who was a contemporary, compare?
Basil doesn't agree with him on this.
Exactly.
Doesn't agree with him.
It'd be good to see anything written by St. Basil the Great against universalism, though it's saying
contemporaries. Not Gregory Nazianzus, Basil, nobody agreed with him on that.
St. Gregory the theologian?
Didn't agree with him on that.
Yeah.
So
he was with Origen and the others.
Yeah, even though the others were also influenced by Origen, but not on this issue. The trouble is with Gregory is that he seems to contradict himself. He says in many places hell is eternal, and then he says other things, and that's the confusing thing.
Mm. We're speculating, we're making assumptions, and we could be making assumptions that are way off base.
That's right.
For the whole Church to be accepting of him and not of Origen, clearly that indicates that in real life he must have been a very sober-minded person. And like Abbas was saying, it's his thought process. It's not his conclusion.
That's right.
Firstly, I was just got to say, it's wonderful that you have all these questions, discussion. I don't want to stop it. I want it to continue all night. But some people need to leave. And this is not the end of the discussion, because hopefully after we finish with the prayer in a moment, all those who can and want will go to the hall and we can continue the discussion, okay? But some people do need to leave. A couple of things, if I can just add a couple of things to the discussion before we wind up. Remember, when we're looking at the church fathers, we never, ever, ever pick one father and make him the know-all of all our faith. We speak in the church of the consensus of the fathers. And sometimes, as Nick explained, the fathers sometimes express things in a way that is unacceptable to the church. You're going to find that if you look at the fathers. But always you should ask yourself, okay, this is what this particular father says on this point, but what's the church understood through the ages of what we call the mind or the consensus of the fathers? The other thing to say is that it is dogma of the church, as in a doctrine of our Orthodox faith, that hell is eternal. Our Lord expressed it very clearly. I think what some of these fathers, in expressing what they do in this way, I've got a feeling that they're saying that, you know, God is so loving, he doesn't want to lose anyone. Even the loss of the devil is a pain to God, who is one of his beloved children. So I think it's going towards that way of thinking, as we said, that's their discussion. And God is so loving, he does not wish the loss of one individual of his created beings. So anyway, the discussion to be continued. Through the prayers of our holy fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well.